All right, so this month we're talking about science versus religion. Key word there being versus. There seems to be a conflict. There seems to be some sort of war, some sort of battle going on, at least in the culture's eyes, right, between science, so-called, and religion. And I want to set up the conflict for you guys. I want to, at least, if this is the first time you're hearing, oh, there's a conflict? What conflict? What's going on? I thought science and religion were cool. What's going on here? Well, let me set it up for you. There's been some statements, and you might have heard some of these. These are kind of cliches, but then there's also quotes from some certain scientists that I'll share with you. Well, but let me know if you've ever heard this quote. Science flies you to the moon. Religion flies you into buildings. Any of you heard that one before? No. I made it up, guys. I'm really evil inside. Science flies you to the moon. Religion flies you into buildings. It's catchy. It has a force to it. And, you know, if somebody ever told you that on the street, start thinking, how would I respond? Would that kind of throw me back? You know, how do I respond to that? How about this one? Science deals with facts and religion deals with faith. I think if you went to the tactics class especially, you might realize, oh, there's something wrong with that cliche already. This one's similar, just using kind of different words, but religion is based on dogma while science is based on evidence. All right, that really kind of clears up the previous cliche. Religion based on dogma while science is based on evidence. Basically, this person who would say that would believe that faith is kind of a blind leap, right? Faith is not based on evidence. I've heard this being said on interviews and from certain scientists. They say, you know, the whole reason that I don't have religion or have faith is because, think about this, me as a scientist, if I were to just say God did it, then we would just give up exploring and researching from that point on. Imagine you come across a tough problem. Imagine mathematicians or scientists doing experiments in the lab, and all of a sudden, you know what, this is too hard. I'm just going to say God did it. And my work here is done. I'm going to go home and be a happy scientist. That's the view that a lot of scientists and skeptics have about faith, about religion. And when you try to intermingle faith with science, they believe that it's a science stopper, essentially. All right? So we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But I want to share some quotes with you from, I've mentioned these names before. They're called the New Atheists. One of them is Sam Harris. He graduated in neuroscience, but he wrote a book, a little tiny book. It was his response to some of the critiques that he got about his first book that basically promoted atheism. And it's called Letter to a Christian Nation. And in here he says, "The truth, however, is that the conflict between religion and science is unavoidable. The success of science often comes at the expense of religious dogma. The maintenance of religious dogma always comes at the expense of science." So right there, he draws a clear line between religion and science. They cannot live, they cannot coexist. In fact, they are polar opposites. While one increases, the other has to decrease, in his eyes at least, right? That's Sam Harris. Richard Dawkins, who I think is probably the most popular pop atheist today, he says this. Creationists, basically anybody who believes that the universe was created, creationists eagerly seek a gap in present-day knowledge or understanding. If an apparent gap is found, it is assumed that God, by default, must fill it. So again, it's like that little scenario that I brought up, that what if a scientist were to just say, this problem that I have before me, this experiment that I have before me that I'm working on, it's just too difficult. I can't figure it out. Therefore, God must have done it. I don't know what the answer is. I'm just going to say God did it. And this is what Richard Dawkins is saying, that if you're a person of faith, if you have a religion, he's comparing you to this kind of, if you try to do science, you're this type of person, kind of dim-witted. You're not willing to put in the hard work to really find answers. You're just going to say God did it and give up. Another quote, he kind of expands on this idea from Richard Dawkins. He says, "If you don't understand how something works, never mind. Just give up and say God did it. You don't know how the nerve impulse works? Good. You don't understand how memories are laid down in the brain? Excellent. If photosynthesis is a bafflingly complex process, wonderful. Please don't go to work out on the or to work on the problem. Just give up and appeal to God. So that's what his kind of mocking of Christians or just a religious person in general. That's what the religious person would be saying. So that's those are some quotes that I wanted to share with you, but also current events. These are some I want to share with you some current events, some things that are happening within the past few years that show that there is this kind of real life effect on individuals' lives when they try to intermingle their faith with science. All right, the first one I want to share with you is actually, how many of you have seen the documentary Expelled? Has Ben Stein on it, and it kind of goes through intelligent design, and he actually shares an example there where an astronomer who is he's pretty widely known, he's a proponent of intelligent design, but from an astronomical level. So he shows how planets, he created a documentary, his name's Guillermo Gonzalez, and he created a documentary called The Privileged Planet, and he shows how there's just these certain constants of physics, where the Earth is situated in the universe, where the Earth is situated in the solar system and in the galaxy, the odds of the Earth being put there and the odds of life coming about are just so astronomically high, it must be design, okay? So that's his version of intelligent design. Well, in 2007, he used to work at Iowa State University as an astronomer, okay? Now, he was up for tenure. Now, if you know about college professors, you got to do a research for a number of years. You got to put out. You got to get funding. And at a certain point, somewhere down the line, they're going to put you up for tenure. They're going to interview you and say, hey, are you a good fit for our university? Well, he was there at that process. And lo and behold, he was very outspoken with his intelligent design supporting. And lo and behold, he got denied tenure. All right. Now, the official statement from the university was that, oh, well, it had nothing to do with his intelligent design beliefs. It wasn't a great fit for us. And likewise, you know, he believes that the university wasn't a good fit for him. Well, if you kind of do a little digging and you look at, there was a Freedom of Information Act. That's not the official name, but for the university. And you see the emails that were being passed around by these professors in that department. And they were, I mean, every other word was, it's because of his intelligent design beliefs. We can't let this guy get tenure here. All right? And they were basically ridiculing him. Now, a couple of professors were like, hey, we shouldn't be talking about him behind his back like this. But yeah, this was going on behind the scenes. So that's what I'm trying to say, is that this conflict, it is actually affecting real people's lives. Okay? So this is an actual real life issue. It's kind of serious. Okay? Also, another topic, current event, where we see this apparent conflict between science and religion has to deal with the beginning of the universe. The beginning of the universe, right? So if you guys have been here in the class long enough, if you remember, we had a class where we went over the cosmological argument. Cosmological argument just showing that we have evidence to show that God is the creator of the universe. He must be the creator of the universe. Because we showed that there... scientifically and philosophically, there must be a beginning to the universe, okay? Now, so that's what we learned from that class. But in the last few years, we've seen some famous scientists, or physicists rather, like Stephen Hawking. Who's heard the name Stephen Hawking? He deals with string theory, he deals with black holes. He's the guy who appears in The Simpsons a lot, and he's on the wheelchair and stuff. Okay, you guys, you know. Stephen Hawking. Lawrence Krauss, he's an up-and-coming, he's a pretty famous scientist now. He's very vocal anti-theist, I would say. I think he would call himself that as well. He works at Arizona State University, I believe. He's a theoretical physicist. But he goes around with Richard Dawkins, and they actually have a documentary out where they go and share their beliefs on atheism. But these guys have now been trying to put forth theories that attempt to deny a bringing into existence of the universe from nothing. So the currently held belief, or kind of for a few decades at least, was that, yes, there was a definite beginning to the universe. All right, that happened around the 50s and 60s. But now these guys are coming up and releasing papers, and they're trying to develop their mathematical theories and putting out papers trying to deny the absolute beginning of the universe. Now, why would anybody want to do that? I think we know. And these guys aren't hiding their cards. These guys are very open. Yeah, I'm trying to get around the fact that there's a definite beginning to the universe. Okay? And they do this in two ways. Stephen Hawking, what he does is that he tries to show that time, if you scale it backwards, time does not have an absolute boundary. So think about, if you're counting backwards from 100, you're eventually going to get to zero. And for at least the universe, when there's nothing beyond zero, right? You can't go negative time. But for Stephen Hawking, he tries to show that. Think of his model shows, like, instead of a cone where this is zero, he tries to show more of this. So, you go back in time, the universe is nothing. And then, but at some time in the past, you know, basically the universe shrank and then it expanded again. That's what he tries to show. And then Lawrence Krauss, I think, is kind of, it almost borders on the level of, like, is this a joke? What he does is he tries to show that the universe came from nothing, but I'm going to redefine what nothing means. All right. So if I were to ask any of you, hey, what is nothing?
Nothing.
It's the total absence of something, right? Some people have been like, what do I have in my hand? Nothing. Or I think it was Aristotle who said, nothing is what rocks dream about, right? We know conceptually what nothing is, but leave it up to Lawrence Krauss and other scientists, physicists, who are now trying to redefine words that we all know. But what's interesting is that you read their papers and they don't tell you what they're redefining, that they're redefining nothing. They will use that word nothing over and over again. But they don't tell you that what they're doing is redefining the word to mean this kind of bubbling vacuum of has gravitational laws. And if you just wait long enough, these gravitational laws and this quantum chaos will suddenly burst into a universe, right? Whereas you talk to a philosopher of science, they're going to tell you, no, nothing is the total absence of anything. Therefore, when you have nothing, there are no properties. There's nothing that exists that can pop anything into being, all right? But if you want to learn more about that, I encourage you to hit me up if you want to listen to the cosmological argument class, and we go into that into more detail. So that's two-thirds of the conflict. And then I'm sure you guys have maybe heard some of these examples. How many of you heard the story of Galileo and how Galileo, when he tried to show the church that there was a widely held belief up until then that the Earth was the immovable planet and that everything revolved around the Earth? Lo and behold, Galileo came along and Copernicus, and they started showing, actually, we're revolving around the sun, as do the other planets. The Earth is not the center of the universe, all right, or the planetary system at the time. And apparently, according to this widely held, circulated story about Galileo, it tries to show that there's a conflict between religion and science. The story goes that, you know, Galileo took, you know, he's just armed, and I'll read it here. Armed only with a telescope and reason, plucky Galileo stood against the might of the church. He was tortured by the Inquisition, condemned as a heretic, and wasted away in a prison cell. Italian science floundered from that point on. You guys have not heard that story? I'm sure some of you have. And, you know, I remember when I first heard it, I was like, oh, man, come on, church. You know, like, come on, man. Can't be doing this to scientists. But, yeah, so some of you heard that one. How about the idea that people in the medieval ages believed, like pretty much everybody in the medieval ages believed that the Earth was flat? How many of you heard that one before? Right?
People still believe that.
Yes. Very few people. She's like, I have three friends. All right, yeah, so the idea here is that, yeah, people, when I speak of medieval ages, like between the years of 500 AD to 1500 AD, that apparently the majority of, especially people who believed in God, and there is some truth, and we'll talk about it later, but they try to use the Bible to justify, oh yeah, the earth is flat, all right? But that's, skeptics will usually bring this objection to a, well, you know, it wasn't just long ago that Christians used to believe that the earth was flat. That's the way they'll bring it up. And you're just like, how am I supposed to respond to that? Is this true? What's going on? So we'll talk about that a little later. Or how many of you have heard, this is the last example, how many of you have heard of the Scopes trial, the Scopes monkey trial, right? This was this famous trial. I've never seen the movie, but it's called Inherit the Wind. I forget who was a famous actor there, and he went on to do other stuff. Anyways, this is also supposed to show an apparent conflict between science and religion, because at that moment, Darwinian evolution was starting to grab a foothold in the public school system being taught. But in Tennessee, at least, there was a law against it, and a teacher kind of courageously, or so the story goes, courageously taught evolution in the classroom when it was against the law. He went to court, and the people who were on the stand, witness stand for Christianity at least, just made fools of themselves, especially according to the movie, if you watch the movie. And yeah, it's supposed to basically show Christians are dim-witted, they're anti-science, they don't know a lick about science, they're not with the times, whereas science and reason is put on this pedestal, and we're supposed to kind of take that story and swallow it and be like, oh no. And if you're a Christian, you're supposed to leave watching that movie with your tail between your legs, you know, and just like, man, I guess there is this conflict between religion and science, right? So that's how the popular story goes, but again, we'll talk about that towards the end. So yeah, this is the conflict, guys. I think we're all, at least all of us, kind of can cover some of these examples here. We've heard some of these quotes. Some of us have heard are aware of some of the current events that are going on. And then some of us are definitely aware of these popular stories that have been circulated, okay? Well, of course, the question is there really a conflict? We have science on one hand and religion on the other. Is it really a science versus religion thing? What is he going to say next? What's the answer? No, exactly. I say no. I'm hoping to show you, and I think a lot of us in here would say no, but what is the reason, right? That's the whole purpose of this apologetics class, is to give reasons for what we believe. So we want to show why we believe these things, okay? So going with the answer, no, there is no conflict, but I'm going to give three responses, okay? Three responses, and they should be on your study guide. One of them is going to be, no, there is no conflict between religion and science because of the assumptions of science. That's the first one. The second response is going to be, no, there is no conflict between religion and science because of, if you look at the history of science. All right. And then the last one is going to be, no, there is no conflict between religion and science because there are certain limitations to science, to what science can answer. Okay? So those are the three responses. Let's look at the first one. Assumptions of science. There are certain assumptions that science makes. Science, the scientific method in general, a method of inquiry about finding out what we know about the natural world, right? Now, if you notice that first question, what is scientism? Notice it's scientism, not science or scientific. There's a difference between science and scientism. Scientism is kind of gaining a foothold amongst a lot of scientists these days, especially skeptical or atheistic scientists and stuff like that. And basically, scientism is the conviction that only scientific knowledge is a form of knowledge. So it's basically saying, look, if I can't do an experiment, and if I can't run it through a test tube, if I can't look at it through a telescope or a microscope, you know, if I can't run experiments on it, then whatever conclusion you draw from anything else outside of the scientific method, it's useless to me. It's meaningless. That's scientism. All right. So people like Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, Stephen Hawking, they would hold to kind of this hard scientism belief that basically, look, if I'm not in the lab and I'm not doing experiments and you're trying to tell me, you know, to change my beliefs on something, it's going to be meaningless to me unless I can actually do a science experiment on it, okay? So that's what scientism is. And that's kind of the going mentality that a lot of atheistic or skeptical scientists have today. All right, so when you try to tell them, hey, there was this man named Jesus, he was a Nazarene, and he died for your sins, you know, around 2,000 years ago, they can be like, I didn't see it. Why doesn't he appear to me now? Why didn't anybody catch him on YouTube, right? Why isn't he Snapchatting me? I don't know. You know, if I can't see him, this guy didn't exist. Therefore, his death on the cross didn't mean anything. It's just an allegory. It's a metaphor. All right, you understand? You're starting to see the going mentality here? So that's scientism. All right, this conviction that scientific knowledge is the highest or even only form of knowledge. And obviously, when you're doing a science experiment and you're already assuming that there can only be a natural explanation, that there is no supernatural, that there can be no supernatural cause, you're kind of already setting yourself up. You're basically assuming the conclusion before you even start. Okay? And I think we can all see here that this form of thinking is self-refuting. It blows up on itself. Because think about it this way. I'm a scientist, and I tell you, I believe that the only way to have or gain any knowledge in this world is through the scientific method. Now, if you've been through the tactics class, what would be the first question you should ask me? Or what would be the first thing you would tell me?
Disprove
me. Say it.
Can we test that?
Test what?
Your scientific method.
What I said, right? Yeah. Can you test that belief? Can you actually make a scientific experiment out of that belief? That's self-refuting, basically. If I say that the only way that I can gain knowledge is through the scientific method, my belief should be subject to the scientific method. But it's not. My belief is a philosophical statement. It's not bounded by the realm of science. So it's self-refuting. You're basically assuming the conclusion before you set out to do anything. So that's why, fundamentally, scientism just doesn't work. But good luck explaining that to a scientist, right? But just know that it's self-refuting. You have nothing to worry about on that end. So if somebody comes up to you and tries to expound on that belief to you and say, oh man, you got to believe in science. No, tell them, no, it's self-refuting. It doesn't make sense. All right. Okay. So that's answer number one. What is scientism? But now, you know, let's continue on. What are the assumptions that science must make in order to actually get off the ground and get going? How are we able to even do science, right? So an astronomer looking through the telescope, a chemist looking through the microscope, and a biologist looking through a microscope or looking at living things, right? How are these guys actually able to do science? What assumptions are they making? Well, there's 10 assumptions. And guess what? All of these 10 assumptions cannot be scientifically verified. So you can actually, if you're speaking with a scientist of some sort, you can actually let them know, hey, isn't it interesting, if you believe that science is the only way to gain knowledge, what do you do with these assumptions? Because they can't be scientifically verified. They are just assumed right at the outset. And that's the only way you can even do science in the first place. You have to make these assumptions. So let's go through these 10. And let's see if you guys agree with them. Number one, and they're going to get a little heady, you know, but don't worry about it. You can kind of concentrate on a couple of them that will work best in a conversation. The first one is, we assume that there's an existence of a theory-independent external world, or basically the existence of an external world, right? Basically, I'm not a mind in a vat. There, this real world, you guys really do exist. You are not just a projection of my imagination. That's the first assumption, right? Because think about it. If you're an astronomer and you're looking out into space and the stars and the planets and galaxies and universes, or not universes, but galaxies and all that, you actually must assume, yes, those things actually do exist. That's the reason I can actually interact with them and make calculations and prove stuff, all right? That's the first one. The second assumption is we assume, as scientists, that the external world is orderly. It's not chaotic. So imagine that. You're trying to do an experiment on, will the sun rise tomorrow? You do an experiment for 100 days. It seems that the sun is rising. But what if on the 101st day, the sun doesn't rise? Oh my gosh. No, we assume that the external world is orderly, that it does follow this kind of pattern. There are certain patterns we can expect in the world. It's not just going to be chaos. Imagine if the world was just entire chaos. You would never be able to perform any type of experiment. All right? That's another assumption. The third assumption is we assume that we can actually know or find things out about the external world. All right, so this is a little different than the second one, that the world is orderly. But this one has to deal with us, the fact that we are actually even able to discover things about the world. We assume that. The fourth one, I think, is self-evident, but it has to be... if you want to be really technical and really thorough, the fourth assumption is we assume that truth exists. Imagine if we didn't assume that truth exists. Then how in the world could we ever trust anything that our eyes see or any words that come out of your mouth? We assume that truth exists and we can actually know this truth. That's the third assumption and the fourth assumption along with it. The fifth assumption is a goodie, is we assume that the laws of logic exist. The laws of logic. So there's three fundamental laws: law of identity, law of excluded middle, law of non-contradiction. This is the way we're even able to have conversations. You don't think that I'm... breaking the laws of logic here. We assume that we all have to abide by the laws of logic. Not only us, but the fact that I know that there cannot be two things, two bodies, or say two planets in the same place at the same time, in the same sense. I know that the world is orderly and it does not break the laws of logic. But I must assume the laws of logic. All right, so even babies know the laws of logic, okay? We all abide by these things, but we just assume that they work, all right? But how does a scientist account for these things? Number six is the reliability of our cognitive faculties to serve as truth gatherers. Basically, the reliability of our mind and of our senses, all right? And so this, I think, is a big kind of defeater for evolution, is if evolution is true, right, how in the world can I even trust my mind if it's just a product? Evolution is not aimed at truth. Evolution is just aimed at survival. But for a scientist to even do science at all, you have to assume that you can trust that the data, the information that you're getting into your brain and you're processing is reliable. So you have to assume that your brain is processing that information reliably. You have to assume that your senses, so your eyes, if you're, you know, working in the ground and you're doing experiments that way, you have to assume that the stuff that you're feeling and smelling and all that, you have to assume that all of your cognitive faculties and your sense experience is reliable. All right, so that's a big one. But how can you account for that, right? The seventh assumption is, we assume that language is adequate to describe the world. That's a big assumption. What if we look at the world out there, but what if we weren't able to describe it? What if it wasn't open to us in that way? Like, oh man, I know what I'm looking at, but I can't describe it in words, in English words, or whatever language you're dealing with. We assume that our language that we've developed, the information that we're able to explain in language, is enough to describe the scientific findings that we're doing through these experiments. The eighth assumption, the existence of values in science. The existence of values. Think of moral values, okay? So the existence of moral values. We're assuming this. So for instance, we assume that scientists test their theories fairly and that they report their results honestly. That's a big assumption to make, you know? There's a lot of people who have gone against that for sure. Exactly. But we assume that this is, in order for science to progress, in order for science to be science and good science, that this is going to be it. You know, that I'm going to trust the scientists to pull in the data correctly and to disseminate it honestly. All right. The ninth assumption is the uniformity of nature and induction. The uniformity of nature and induction. So this is related to the orderliness of the world. But the fact that I'm able to extrapolate. If you remember in the logic class, induction, you're getting very specific samples, and then you're extrapolating that data to draw more general conclusions. All right? So if you told me, if you gave me like three oranges, and you told me, hey, this came from a bigger batch of oranges, and I investigate the properties of one of the oranges, and I can assume, I can by inductive reasoning, I can say, oh, the bigger batch of oranges are spherical. They have this orange peel to them. You know, the orange whatever. So you can investigate those properties, and then you can extrapolate onto more general conclusions. That's inductive reasoning. So we assume that we can actually use inductive reasoning in science in order to draw reliable conclusions, because we assume that there's uniformity in nature. And then the last assumptions that science makes to even be able to get off the ground is the existence of numbers. And you're like, what? Are you serious? Existence of numbers. So think about it. Think about what kind of dilemma a scientist who holds to scientism has. If you can only rely on scientific method to give you any form of knowledge, how can you account for numbers? What kind of scientific method or scientific experiment can you run in order to show that numbers do exist? No, we already assume right off the bat there are such a thing as numbers. So you say, I have two oranges in my hand. Two? What? Or think about this statement. The number two is even. The number two? Where is the number two? Where is it? You know? No. We assume that numbers exist, but they're abstract, but that we can actually interact with them and use them in our scientific reasoning. Okay? So those are the 10 assumptions. I know a lot of them are, you know, kind of heady, but I would say probably the biggest ones that you can use, definitely the laws of logic, the existence of truth. So number 5 and 6, or rather 4 and 5. And also number 1, the existence of an external world. I think those would kind of get you far in a conversation, at least just to start off a conversation. I know none of us are like Albert Einstein's in here or Stephen Hawking's, so we don't have to argue on that kind of high level. But just to show a general skeptic, your average Joe skeptic, I think kind of concentrating on those assumptions would get you far in a conversation that you're having with an unbeliever, okay? Okay, so those are the assumptions made by science. Now I want to actually talk about this next part will cut like right into the crucial question about, is there an actual conflict between religion and science? And it's going to answer the question, well, how does science help theology? Or how does science help religion and vice versa? That should be the next question, right? Is it even the case that science can help theology? There's five ways that science can help theology or vice versa, that theology can help science, okay? And check this out. The first way that science can help theology is that science can actually help you verify certain claims made by theology, all right? Verify religious claims. All right, maybe some of you can actually help me, give me an example. What are some claims made by a religious system that science can actually help verify? Can anybody think of one?
The parting of the Red Sea.
The parting of the Red Sea. So was there an actual historical event where the Red Sea parted? That's a good one.
The flood.
The flood. Noah's flood. Yep. Any other examples?
Location.
The what?
A location.
A location?
Jerusalem, you know, places where things happen.
Okay, so a location found within a religious text.
Yep.
Okay, good.
Isaiah or somewhere in there talks about the earth being round. It doesn't say that in that, but it indicates that the earth is not a flat surface.
It, yep, I'm actually going to share that verse a little later.
I think it was in Isaiah.
Yeah, I believe it is Isaiah 40-something. But yes, that's a claim found in a religious text that science can actually help verify. Yeah?
Sweat and blood, when Jesus sweats the blood.
Yeah, is this an actual condition?
Yeah.
How do we take this text? Is it literal or is it more metaphorical? Well, we can actually show that, yeah, it is a medical condition for sure. I'm thinking Genesis 1:1, there is a beginning of the universe, right? And we've shown through the cosmological argument, right, that science has helped us show, yes, there is a beginning to the universe, right? So, yeah, there's, think outside of Christianity even. Hindu systems who are even pantheistic religions that believe that the universe is eternal. Well, this is what I like to share with skeptics is the fact that, hey, look, all religious systems make claims about reality, all right? And the one I like to share is that, look, there are... every religion will have to answer the question, where did we come from? Or how did we get here, right? So your pantheistic religions like Hinduism and Buddhism and all those, they'll mainly claim that the universe is eternal. There is no creation to the universe. It's always been. And then I like to show them, well, Christianity at least says that there's a beginning to the universe. These are claims about reality made by each religion here. And I can actually use science to help guide me to the correct answer. Science is showing, by far, that there is a beginning to the universe. Therefore, that helps me on my religious quest, if I were on one, but I'm sharing with a skeptic, right? Hey, you're a skeptic, you're looking for what is the right religion, if there is any? I can already tell you, discount the pantheistic religions. Don't look at those. I can look to Mormonism, investigate Mormonism, find out scientific claims about that, like Lowell brought up. Is there an actual location called Nauvoo, right? Is there an actual archaeological dig that has dug up these locations found in the Book of Mormon? No. I can discount Mormonism, all right? That's how science can help theology. It helps us kind of narrow down our pickings of each religion, and ultimately, I think Christianity is by far and above the best one, right? The most widely claimed. So that's the first way that science can help theology. The second way that science can help theology is that science, or theology can help science in this case, is that science encounters metaphysical problems which religion can help solve. Now, what do I mean by that, metaphysical problems? Well, think about it. sometimes science, like for instance, the beginning of the universe, that's a popular one. Science can actually show us, yes, there is a beginning to the universe. But the inevitable question is, what caused the beginning of the universe? Or why? Why did the universe come into being? Or why does anything at all exist? All right, so science can actually take you just so far and show, yeah, more than likely there is a beginning to the universe. But we answer, especially philosophers will ask the more deeper questions about, well, why does the universe even exist? Even if the universe was eternal, you would still want to answer the question, why? Why does anything exist at all? But we know the universe had a beginning, so we ask the question, well, how did it come into existence? Science can't answer that. But theology can actually help you answer that. Obviously, we have Christianity. We have the Bible that shows Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created. And as I mentioned, there's other religious texts that will have their own version. Oh, well, the universe just always is. The universe is part of this deity. We are all parts of this deity. Does that make sense? Theology is trying to answer these questions, and they may be later verified by science. But theology is actually having a helping hand in some cases, verifying certain scientific experiments, okay? So whenever science comes up against a wall, in comes theology. Hey, help me answer this issue. What makes the best sense here? All right? That's one way that theology can help science. Another way that theology can help science is religion can augment the explanatory power of science. So, for instance, let's say I have two competing theories in science. All right, whatever the case may be. I think the one I read about was theory of relativity, right? So which theory of relativity makes more sense? There was an Einsteinian view and there was a Leibnizian view. I think that's how you pronounce it. But there were certain assumptions made about time. Is time eternal, or does time have an absolute beginning? Well, theology can actually help us. Me as a Christian, I believe time actually had a definite beginning. In the beginning, God created. And that helps me actually choose between two competing theories, scientific theories, okay? If you guys ever read any, scientific papers or anything like that, and you might see, oh, these two theories are coming up. Which one explains reality the best? Well, I'm going to use my theological background, my theological views, in helping me understand better which one should I go with here. Okay? I think this one might go, theology can help you understand the question, is time travel even possible? All right? Back to the Future, I'm sorry. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, I'm sorry. You're cool to watch. But you're not true. All right, that's the third way. One way that science can help theology is that science can establish a premise in an argument that has religious significance. Now, what do I mean by this? Again, I would point you back to our study on the cosmological argument. And premise, that's a very specific word, right? When we're talking about premises and conclusions, we're talking about deductive arguments. And that's something we studied, way back when in the beginning of the class. But basically, there's two premises and then a conclusion. Well, we can actually have scientific evidence to help us establish or make sure that a certain premise in my argument is, in fact, correct. And that actually helps my deductive argument have a true conclusion. All right? All that to say that it's basically showing that science doesn't necessarily prove God exists or anything like that. But science helps me come closer to that conclusion by giving me evidence in order to prove a premise in a religious argument, a religious deductive argument, something like that. So that's another way that science can help theology. Lastly, religion, and this is what we're going to talk about right after this, is religion furnishes the conceptual framework in which science can flourish. Specifically, I believe, Christian theism. And that's a good segue into our next question. Is kind of the history of science. And after I explain this, we'll take a break. The history of science, of modern science, right? The fact that we can look into telescopes far, far away, make certain hypotheses. We can either support or deny our hypotheses, but ultimately we can arrive at a conclusion. That's what we all would consider the scientific method, right? The fact that we can make a hypothesis, do some experimentations, we repeat those experiments to kind of get a pattern, and those experiments, the conclusions we get from those, either support or reject our hypothesis, right? We all remember doing a science project in school. We remember getting the little little poster board. I didn't know anything about that stuff. But I still got third place. Tell you what. What's that? Yeah. Man, it's your first time here, man. What's going on, bro? I'm going to get this heckler out of here. Babe, you're supposed to be my muscle. Come on. All right. History of science. So remember, our last way that we saw that theology or religion can help science is the fact that theology, and specifically Christian theism, provides a framework where science can flourish. And I bet, I didn't know this until recently, but the fact that modern science, the way we know science is done today, all right, chemists, biology, astronomy, physics, all that, there's a reason why modern science got off the ground at a certain time and place. If you don't know this, modern science actually took off in Western Europe, all right? There were beginnings of it around the 13th century, but it didn't actually start flourishing until the 16th century, all right? We have people like Isaac Newton, Kepler, I'm drawing a blank, but we'll mention some names later. But there's a reason why science, modern science, actually took off in that time period and in Western Europe. Western Europe was dominated by Christianity, all right? Now, modern science did not thrive in Asia, in the Orient. There's a reason why Chinese Buddhists and Hindus and those religions, specific religions, did not provide a framework for modern science to flourish. In Africa, and you had all these animistic religions, there's a reason why science did not take off there. Even in Eastern Europe, where you had domination of Greek thought, Greek philosophy and all that, reasoning was the epitome of man. There's a reason why science didn't take off there. All right, well, why is it that science took off in Western Europe in the time that it did? And I'll read a quote here. To understand why science was attractive even before it could demonstrate its remarkable success in explaining the universe, it is necessary to look at things from a medieval point of view. The starting point for all natural philosophy in the Middle Ages was that nature had been created by God. That was the fundamental assumption. Nature had been created by God, Genesis 1:1. This made it a legitimate area of study because through nature, man could learn about its creator. Man, I really love reading the Bible. Think of, you know, I'm a budding scientist in the Middle Ages. I really wanted to learn more about God. I love reading my Bible. I wish there were another way to know about God. The world is made by God. I'm made in the image of God. If God is the creator of the universe, maybe I could find out more about him through nature. Is anybody bringing to mind Romans chapter 1? We are all without excuse. It is evident through creation, the nature of the Godhead and his power. Continuing on. Medieval scholars thought that nature followed the rules that God had ordained for it. Because God was consistent, these natural laws were constant and worth scrutinizing. However, these scholars rejected Aristotle's contention that the laws of nature were bound by necessity. God was not constrained by what Aristotle thought. The only way to find out which laws God had decided on was by the use of experience and observation. The motivations and justification of medieval natural philosophers were carried over almost unchanged by the pioneers of modern science. So you understand there, the fundamental assumption there was that we are created by God. This universe is created by God. And the only way that I'm going to understand what God has done and how he did it is by getting my hands dirty, is by doing some observations, by doing experiments. All right? Now, it's very interesting because we're going to look at why science did not take off for, say, polytheistic religions. Okay, so let's look at polytheism for a little bit. It's not the worship of Polyphos here. It's the belief that there are many gods, right? Polytheistic religions. Why didn't science take off under that framework? So think about this. Finite gods. Usually in polytheistic religions. So think of like your Greek mythology. All these gods, they were not eternal. They were created. Right? So you had these finite gods. Finite gods do not create the universe. Indeed, the universe creates them. So they are generally said to arise out of some pre-existing primordial stuff. For example, in the genealogy of the gods of Greece, the fundamental forces such as chaos gave rise to Gaia, the Great Mother, who created and then mated with the heavens and the sea to give birth to the gods. In a polytheistic worldview, the universe itself is not the creation of a rational mind and is therefore not thought to have rational order. So if you have all these competing gods, which none of them created the universe, then there's no real grounding rationality behind the universe. So I wouldn't have an expectation to think that I can actually go out and expect to do experiments and expect to have rational conclusions. It just doesn't work that way. But for Christians, the basis for believing that there can be universal laws of nature is the fact that there is one God who actually created the universe. So we expect rationality, because you don't have competing gods. Who's going to win out? You only have one God. He's a rational God, and he actually created the universe. Think of Psalm 19:1. The heavens declare the glory of God, of one God. So I can actually expect to go and look at the heavens. What are they declaring to me? All right. What about Eastern pantheism? Pantheism. Why didn't modern science flourish under pantheism? So if polytheism involves personal but finite gods, pantheism is the opposite. Non-personal god and infinite deities. So they're non-personal and infinite. The god of pantheism is not really a being so much as what we might call an essence. So think of, like, if you watch the movie Avatar, we had Gaia, who's kind of like this, the sub-force of all the universe. It's kind of this essence. It really doesn't have a personality, right? Essences do not create worlds because they are not personal agents. So they do not actually do anything. As a result, once again, there is no confidence that the universe is the creation of a rational mind. Moreover, rationality implies differentiation. But when pantheism, think of like Hinduism, we're all part of God. This table is part of God. The wall is part of God. We are part of God. There's no differentiation, right? So you can't expect to go and experiment and expect to think that, oh, I'm actually experimenting something that's different than me. And I want to understand the properties. Because if your going assumption in pantheism is that, oh, we're all part of the same reality or the same essence, you're not going to get really anywhere with that kind of thinking. When Marxist historian Joseph Needham studied Chinese culture, he wanted to know why the Chinese did not develop modern science. And he concluded that the reason lay in the Chinese view of creation. This was his quote. There was no confidence that the code of nature's laws could be unveiled and read, because there was no assurance that a divine being, even more rational than ourselves, had ever formulated such a code capable of being read. All right? So they had, again, they didn't have an assumption of a rational mind behind the universe. All right, next up is classical Greek philosophy. The Greeks. These guys elevated reason above anything. They didn't want to get their hands dirty. That's why if you look back in the historical Greek culture, if you're a Greek, you had servants. You had the servants till the land and make things for you. Right. Think of even, this is not Greek, but think of the slavery that Egypt had over the Hebrews, right? They had them do the dirty work while these guys lived it up in palaces. Same thing for Greeks. They wanted to spend all their time kind of getting together and having sipping coffee and just thinking hard about things. They were trying to deduce the facts about the world just by reasoning alone. So they didn't want to get their hands dirty. Well, what's the problem with this? Greek thought was the low value it placed on the material world. matter was seen as less real, the realm of mere appearance. Sometimes they even believed that matter was evil and the spiritual world was good. So think about everything we see here. Outside, in the heavens, all that is matter. They thought, oh yeah, there's an evil nature to it. Why would I even want to bother with that? Many historians believe that this is one reason the Greeks did not develop empirical science. The intellectual elites had no interest in dirtying their own hands with actual experiments, and they had contempt for the farmers and craftsmen who might have acquainted them with hands-on knowledge of nature. Isn't that something, huh? Scientific investigation of nature became... This is kind of concluding the history of science here. The reason that science was able to flourish under a Christian worldview was that scientific investigation of nature became both a calling and an obligation. Historian John Headley Brooke explained that the early scientists would often argue that God had revealed himself in two books, the book of his words, the Bible, and the book of his works, nature. As one was under obligation to study the former, so too there was an obligation to study the latter. And again, we go back to Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. Imagine reading that, and you're just like, man, I can't wait to go out and investigate what is this God like if the heavens are declaring his glory. Okay, so let's continue on with... Now we're going to... It should be the next thing in the study guide is... what actual scientists believed in God that were part of this rise of modern science? Was it actually the case? And what kind of impact did they have? Okay, was it serious enough? Well, let's take a look at... I have eight scientists who were theists and devoted theists, as we'll see. And the first one is one of my favorites, Blaise Pascal. And he lived within the 1600s. He was a French mathematician. Yes, good things can come out of France, I guess.
Can you write your last
yes,
name?
Let me write it down.
Blaise.
Blaise. Pascal. Yes, we owe a lot of things to France. All right. He was a French mathematician, he was a physicist, he was an inventor, he was a writer and a theologian. In mathematics, he published a paper on the subject of projective geometry, don't know what that is, established the foundation for probability theory. He also invented a mechanical calculator, and he established the principles of vacuums and the pressure of air. So this is all when it's just getting started, right? And these guys were at the very forefront of all these discoveries, okay? So that's Blaise Pascal.
And that was the 17th century?
Yes. And he has a programming language named after him. Yeah. What's that?
No, I mean,
yeah, it's named after him. The second one is Johannes Kepler. Johannes. Look, Ma. Johannes. He was late 1500s to early 1600s. He was actually an astronomer, and he formulated the laws of planetary motion, which are now known as Kepler's laws of planetary motion, that were based on observations of a previous astronomer. These are still used to calculate the approximate position of artificial satellites, the outer planets, and smaller asteroids. So if we send a satellite out there and we want to make sure it's not going to hit anything else, we know it won't, or we know where it's going to land because we know the planetary motions. He also did a lot of work in the field of optics. He invented a new type of telescope, which was used to confirm the discoveries of Galileo. All right. So again, he was a big contributor, and he was an avowed theist. Third one is very famous, Isaac Newton.
Yes,
Macintosh had the Newton. For some of you oldies in here. All right, he was mid-1600s to early 1700s. widely recognized as one of the most influential scientists of all time, up there with Albert Einstein. All right, he was a key figure in the scientific revolution for sure. He shared credit with Gottfried Leibniz, who was also another theist, for the development of calculus. All right, so you can blame him for those calculus classes you have to take in college and in high school. He formulated the laws of motion and universal gravitation. So we have an equation for how we can tell what the force, the gravitational force, an object puts on another object, depending on the distance. We have F equals ma, force equals mass times acceleration. This is all devoted to Newton. Yes, I'm nerding out right now. All right. Fourth one is Robert Boyle. He was not sick. That's just his last name. Robert Boyle, early to late 1600s. He and a couple of other people are known as the father of modern chemistry, so depending on who you talk to. Father of modern chemistry. As a devout Protestant, Boyle took a special interest in promoting the Christian religion abroad, giving money to translate and publish the New Testament into Irish and Turkish. In 1690, 1 year before he died, he developed his theological views in The Christian Virtuoso, that was the name of the book, which he wrote to show that the study of nature was a central religious duty. All right. So, I mean, even way back then, in the middle of the scientific revolution, you had these great theists even expounding, saying, hey, Christians, let's get on board. Let's start doing scientific experimentation. Fifth, we have William Thomson Calvin. Thomson, T-H-O-M-S-O-N. There's no P in there. Calvin. He was in the 1800s. He did important work in the mathematical analysis of electricity and in the formulation of the first and second laws of thermodynamics. He worked on thermodynamics. Now, if you know anything about temperature, we have Fahrenheit, centigrade or Celsius, and Kelvin, right? Who knows what absolute zero is?
Really cold.
It's yes.
So cold.
Yes. Who knows what the value of absolute zero is? Celsius. But what is it in Kelvin, or rather Fahrenheit? Who knows Fahrenheit? Minus 4 something? I thought it was 473. I can be wrong.
Zero Kelvin.
Absolute zero. All right, that's Kelvin. Next, we have another one of my favorites, Michael Faraday. If you know what a Faraday cage is. Michael Faraday was in the late 1700s to mid 1800s. He was a chemist and a physicist and also an elder in his church. He established the basis for electromagnetics. And he also established that electromagnetism could affect rays of light. So you remember the cathode ray tube screens? This is his work. He discovered benzene. All right.
Joy.
Yeah. He invented the first working electric motors. Some people think he was the greatest experimenter in the history of science. That is not my opinion. I just saw that somewhere on the internet. I like Tesla, personally.
Yeah.
Seventh, we have James Clerk Maxwell. I wonder if Alex and Patrick are related to him. He's in the 1800s as well. He was a physicist who formulated classical electromagnetic theory into Maxwell's equations. I believe there's either three or four simple equations in electromagnetic theory. I hated that class. What else did he do? He demonstrated that electricity and magnetism travel in waves at the speed of light. Many scientists think he was as important as Einstein and Newton. I forget what the going story of his was. I remember reading that in his lab, he had like a poster or something, a board that had an inscription. I think it was a verse or it was like a theological saying above his laboratory, which I thought was pretty cool. I'll have to look it up. Lastly, we have Gregor Mendel. Is there? Sorry. Mendel. Just add it to your study guide. Gregor Mendel. Who knows what he's the father of?
Mendel.
Botany?
He did do botany, but what is he known as the father of?
Genetics.
There you go. Father of genetics. So he did a lot of work with, he studied the inherited traits of pea plants. He was an Augustinian monk, so this is what monks do, all right? They study pea plants. And so he discovered that inheritance follows certain laws. And I think he had a lot to do with that, I don't remember biology, that square. I forget what the square is called. But what recessive and dominant genes and stuff like that. So he's the father of genetics.
What's it called?
Punnett. Punnett square?
Punnett, yeah.
There you go. You young folks know. Yeah. All right, so that is a list of scientists who were devout believers in God, and they found no conflict between. In fact, they found actually it to be a duty and an obligation for their beliefs in God to go and study the natural world and find out what God has done, how he has ordered the world. And now we have all these great scientific advancements. We have this especially. Thank you, James Clerk Maxwell and Michael Faraday, for that. So, man, everywhere you look, there's so much influence from these theists, from these Christians that had the starting assumption, God created the world, and it's a rational mind behind it, therefore I can actually expect to find rational conclusions. That's amazing. All right, now we want to talk about, quickly, limits of science. And if you didn't know, but now you know, science does have its limits. Science does have its limits. Okay, science is not the be-all and end-all of any rational discussion. But try telling that again to a scientist who holds to scientism, and they'll probably be like, oh, how dare you, blasphemy, right? But here are some limits to science, and actually I want to show you through this pretty neat video. It's a debate, okay? And I almost feel bad for the other guy. It's between William Lane Craig and Peter Atkins. And Peter Atkins, he's an atheist, and he holds to a scientistic worldview, scientism. And he'll actually say, yeah, science is the only way to know for knowledge to happen. And then William Lane Craig's basically going to embarrass him. All right, so here we go. Don't look at my password. Facepalm. All right, here we go. Hopefully you can hear it.
If taken together with a reason why people believe, desperate to believe, together with the fact that you don't need actually a God, in a sense amounts to an argument against the existence of God.
Well, I guess I don't see that. I mean, why doesn't that commit the genetic fallacy of trying to say that by explaining how a belief originates, you thereby show the belief to be false? Even if it were true that belief in the existence of God were the product of fear and anxiety and so forth, which I don't for a minute admit, but even if it were, that's simply a genetic fallacy to say because that's the way the belief was originally,
that's
the
way
therefore the belief is false.
But that's only one half of the argument. I'm not saying that that alone is adequate. And I'm not saying that the fact that science can account for everything in alone is also adequate. But taken together, the fact that that science is omnipotent and the fact that I can understand why people like you desperately want to believe in God. That is an argument against it.
But two fallacious arguments put together don't make a sound argument, right?
Yeah. But do you deny that science cannot account for everything?
Yes, I do deny that science.
So what point did it account for?
Well, had you brought that
here
up
goes.
To the debate, I had a number of examples that I was going to give. I think there are a good number of things that cannot be scientifically proven, but that we're all rational to accept. Let me list five. Logical and mathematical truth cannot be proven by science. Science presupposes logic and math, so that to try to prove them by science would be arguing in a circle. Metaphysical truths, like there are other minds other than my own, or that the external world is real, or that the past was not created 5 minutes ago with an appearance of age are rational beliefs that cannot be scientifically proven. Ethical beliefs about statements of value are not accessible by the scientific method. You can't show by science whether the Nazi scientists in the camps did anything evil as opposed to the scientists in Western democracies. Aesthetic judgments, number four, cannot be accessed by the scientific method because the beautiful likes of good cannot be scientifically proven. And finally, most remarkably, would be science itself. Science cannot be justified by the scientific method. Science is permeated with unprovable assumptions. For example, in the special theory of relativity, the whole theory hinges on the assumption that the speed of light is constant in a one-way direction between any two points, A and B. But that circuit cannot be proven. We should have to assume that in order to hold the theory. None of these beliefs can be scientifically proven, and yet they are accepted by all. None of these.
Right there, that face. I want to pause it right there. So he's just like, what did I just ask? What did I get myself into? All right, there are limits to science, guys. And you see a lot of overlap with the assumptions that science makes because it's just the point of fact that there are some things that science assumes, and it just so happens that they can't be proven by science itself. All right? It was in the middle of a discussion, but Peter Atkins was basically trying to show that combined with the fact that some people believe in God based on like their fears or their feelings or whatever, and then also combined with the fact that we know that science is omnipotent, as he said, he can understand how some people come to believe in God, but that's why he rejects God, because he believes that science is omnipotent.
He desperately needed to believe in God.
Yeah. So... yeah, Peter Atkins is a funny guy. He's old. but yeah, there's limits to science, guys. And they're very important. These, I would encourage you to kind of memorize these. And if you ever come across, you know, a scientist who's very skeptical, who's very grounded in science, that they kind of put science on a pedestal, ask them, okay, you as a scientist, if you believe that science is the only way to account for knowledge, would you admit that these are limits to science? And if you do, if you admit any one of these, then scientism is false. You would have to show them. Scientism is false if any of these. Yeah.
What is the video called?
William Lane Craig humiliates Peter Atkins. Yeah. I'll share the link with you later. All right. So first one, laws of logic, right? We already went over that in the assumptions. Metaphysical truths, like he said, the fact that... What's that? I don't understand.
Numerical logic.
Oh, yeah. Symbolic logic and all that. Yeah. Laws of logic, symbolic logic, all that. Metaphysical truths, like the fact we assume that the world exists. We assume that this whole universe wasn't just created 5 minutes ago with the appearance of age and all that, or I'm not a brain in a vat. Also, the why questions are under the metaphysical truths. It can't answer the why questions, and I'll get into that in a little bit. Science can't answer ethical truths. So remember that cliche that we said in the beginning? Science flies planes to the moon. Religion flies planes into buildings. Well, think of the atom bomb, the creation of the atom bomb. Bunch of scientists. Now, science will get you to a very powerful position. It'll let you create some very powerful things like the atom and the hydrogen bomb. But as those scientists were working on that, I'm sure they all felt the moral dilemma there. Science has let me come this far in technology to build a very powerful weapon. But my scientific knowledge is not going to tell me whether or not it's okay or whether or not it's right or wrong to drop this bomb on people. That is outside of the realm of science. That is moral. That is a moral judgment. That is not a scientific judgment, okay? So that's a big one, ethical one. Science cannot tell you anything about something about beauty, aesthetics. What makes something beautiful? What is the beautiful? Is beauty, I believe, is grounded in the nature of God. That's how we can actually understand that things are beautiful and some things are ugly, right? Objectively. And then, like he mentioned lastly, science itself, the scientific method itself, cannot be proven or shown to be true using the scientific method. We just assume that this is a method of inquiry that we must use, right? So yeah, there are limits to science, and that's okay. That's what I want to let you guys know. It's okay. So if some atheist comes up to you and says, oh man, you don't believe in science. How can you get anywhere? You're just a dumb religious freak, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Tell them, look, I believe in science. Science has a lot of things to show us. We just mentioned the whole list of scientists who have done great things, and some of you may be in the field of science. Science does a lot for us. It helps us answer a lot of awesome questions, and it helps us discover and make advances in technology and all that. Makes our lives a whole lot easier. But it has its limits, and that's okay. Okay? So we don't have to be afraid of an atheist coming up to us and say, why don't you believe in science? Are you anti-science? No, I'm not. I just understand that there's limits to science. And for certain questions, like the why questions, I'm going to be talking to different people other than scientists to answer those questions. Okay. And then talking about the metaphysical truths really quick, specifically the why question, I like this example. It's called Aunt Matilda's Cake. It's a good analogy to show how science works, and it illustrates the limitations. So suppose that your Aunt Matilda baked you a cake, and you brought in scientists to explore and define the material composition of the cake, the fundamental particles, the nutritional effect from the composition of all those eggs, flour, and sugar, the structure of the proteins, etc. What you would have is an explanation of how the cake was made and how the pieces relate to each other. But what if you wanted to know why it was made? Aunt Matilda knows the answer. It was made for her nephew Jimmy's birthday. But science can only explain how it was made, right? How it is created, not why. That is a serious limitation to science. It does not answer the why questions. And those are usually the ones that we're mostly concerned with. Why am I here? You know, where am I going? Those types of questions. Science cannot answer those. Big limitation. All right. Lastly, we're going to talk about, we're going to revisit those myths that we brought up in the beginning, right? The Galileo, the Scopes trial, and the flat earth theory, right? So we mentioned Galileo. A lot of skeptical people, atheists, will try to bring up this objection about Galileo was imprisoned by the church, tortured. He was left to rot away in a prison cell, all because he wanted to show the church his scientific discoveries. Well, the truth is not so cut and dry. It's not so black and white, okay? I love that face that he has up there. He's all, I have just been destroyed. All right. Yes. Peter Atkins is a robot. There's another clip, well, man, where he just gets demolished. It's so sad. Okay. Actually, before we get to Galileo, I want to actually share with you that this very idea that there is a conflict, that there's this been this constant warfare between science and religion, it actually, I'm sorry if I made you turn back. It actually it goes back to two writers from the 19th century. Their names were Andrew Dixon White and John William Draper. Andrew Dixon White, interestingly enough, he was the founding president of Cornell University. And this is all, I don't have the years. Actually, I do have the years. He wrote his piece. It was called, in 1896, he wrote a massive two-volume opus entitled A History of the Warfare of Science with Theology in Christendom. And then in 1874, a couple of decades before White, John Draper published History of the Conflict Between Religion and Science. Draper was actually a professor of chemistry at the University of New York. New York City. Nice. And I want to share with you a couple of, well, one quote from each of these guys' papers, okay? So remember, they're trying to actually show that there's been this constant warfare throughout history between scientific endeavors and religion, all right? Andrew Dixon White wrote this. I propose then, and you can find these free like on Gutenberg.org or something. They're beyond copyright, so you can find them online. I propose then to present to you this evening an outline of the great sacred struggle for the liberty of science, a struggle which has been going on for so many centuries. A tough contest this has been. A war continued longer, with battles fiercer, with sieges more persistent, with strategy more vigorous than in any comparatively petty warfares of Alexander or Caesar or Napoleon. In all modern history, interference with science in the supposed interest of religion, no matter how conscientious such interference may have been, has resulted in the direst evils both to religion and science, and invariably. So he's basically saying it's always existed and the consequences are dire. He makes it sound like it's the end of the world, right? John William Draper said this in his paper, "The antagonism we thus witness between religion and science is the continuation of a struggle that commenced when Christianity began to attain political power. The history of science is not a mere record of isolated discoveries. It is a narrative of the conflict of two contending powers, the expansive force of the human intellect on one side, and the compression arising from traditionary faith and human interests on the other." All right, since Christianity began to attain political power, apparently, that's when science was doomed. All right. And I'll let you know that there's a great book called Galileo Goes to Jail. And they kind of go through the history of all this nonsense, right? But basically, I'm going to let you know that no historian of science or philosopher of science worth his money or salt, whatever you want to call it, I don't know what the cliche is or the idiom, hardly anybody believes that these guys have any backing or have anything of truth value to them, right? These guys actually gained a following for quite a while, but now as you start looking at their premises and their explanations and their theories that they put forth, they're unreliable. They are not good historians. They basically fabricated a lot of things. They distorted a lot of the facts, all right? But this is where it started. That this idea that there's been a constant struggle between science and religion. We can credit these two guys. But now let's revisit Galileo. So as I mentioned, it's not black and white. This story is very complicated, and I will try to do my best to explain it. I know I'm missing a whole lot of details, but bear with me. So we have to first understand that when Galileo was making his discoveries, right? Copernicus came before him, but Galileo is really the one that we concentrate on because of his consequences. But we have to understand that at the time, it was widely held view that the heavens depended on the theories of Aristotle. And basically, he argued that the universe, in the universe, everything revolves around the Earth. The Earth is a stationary planet, and everything revolves around it, right? So that was the going assumption. So if you were doing science, and something didn't fit right, like the orbits of the planets and how they're elliptical and not circular, you had to find a way to reconcile, oh, the Earth is not moving, everything's moving around it, so I have to come up with these complicated equations. Now, so unless there was clear evidence showing the contrary, Galileo's views were not going to be so easily accepted. And so, yeah, he was one of the early supporters of heliocentrism, showing that, oh, we actually revolve around the sun. It's the sun that's the center of our planetary system. This wasn't his original idea, but he was the one that writing papers on it. And he shared these observations with others, including Catholic scientists, as early as 1610. Now, technology being what it was in the 1600s, there were still some certain of his findings that didn't match up with the observations. So remember, I said there had to be clear and convincing evidence in order for people to kind of do away with their Aristotelian view. All right, but he didn't have that. He had some good evidence, but he didn't have it quite enough to convince a lot of people to change their minds. Note, however, that while conflict with scriptural interpretation, so there were theologians that did hold to some certain Bible passages, and we'll share some, but there were some certain Bible passages that theologians would point to and say, it shows here that the earth is the one that does not move, all right? So there was conflict with scriptural interpretation that was part of the decision-making process, but it wasn't the most influential factor. The bulk of the resistance to Galileo was due to the admitted disconnect between his model and the available observation. So basically they're saying, look, you just don't have enough data. Now, what really got things going was when a new pope came into power, and this pope asked Galileo to kind of write a book, write a paper about the best views out there about whether or not the sun is in the center or whether or not the earth is in the center, right? So Galileo wrote this book, and it was called Dialogue Concerning the Two Chief World Systems. This was in 1632. And it's already been 20 years since his initial observations, right? And so there was no conflict for 20 years. People took his observations and were like, okay, well, it's cool, but it doesn't really convince me. There was no conflict. It wasn't until he wrote this book, and he made the Pope a character in this book. It was like a dialogue. And it wasn't directly, you could tell it was the Pope, but the character in the book was called Simplicio, which means simple-minded. All right, so basically he's calling the Pope a dummy. All right, now if you call the Pope a dummy, there's going to be consequences. All right, and that's exactly what happened. You know, they laid the smackdown on him, right? So after Dialogue was published, it wasn't a year, not even a year after, this book was banned. Galileo was brought up on charges of heresy. And this is the sticking point for many critics. They fail to consider the entire sequence of events. Right? This is exactly what you got to show. It wasn't his scientific observations. It was the fact that he's going against the church and he's making fun of people and he's angering people by what he's saying. It's not the scientific observations themselves.
Used questions that the Pope asked him in the book.
Yep.
And attributed to Simplicio.
Yep. Exactly. So yeah, if you were to read that book, you would be like, "That's the Pope." It was clear as day. People knew and understood who he was making fun of. So. But get this. So people think that he was tortured and that he was condemned and that he was just left in a jail cell, right? Well, the actual truth lays out like this. He was brought to Rome, but his penalty was nowhere near as harsh as some have claimed. He was detained, but he was given his own quarters, his own home, and his own servant. And he also received a continued pension. Imagine that for a retirement plan. He later was able to return home. So he couldn't travel freely for a while, but he was still allowed visitors, and he was... At that time, he was able to freely write whatever he chose to write.
Basically, they just didn't know what to do with him.
Yeah, they're just like, whatever, just put him over there, let him write whatever, but he's not going to make fun of me ever again.
Was he ever tortured?
No. Nope. And this is during the years of the Inquisition, where we know people died and were tortured, right? But he was not.
So the minimum security prison here?
Exactly. So yeah, this is Galileo's story. And again, there is scientific element to it, but that was not the driving force behind Galileo's persecution, as it were, okay? Let's revisit the flat earth theory. This whole thing that medieval Christians and were the ones promoting this flat earth idea. And here's a quote I got. With extraordinarily few exceptions, no educated person in the history of Western civilization from the 3rd century BC onward believed that the earth was flat. A round earth appears at least as early as the 6th century BC. Isn't that crazy? Now, some church fathers did believe in a flat earth due to passages like Psalm 104, 2 and 3. You can... read them on your own, but I'll actually mention them here. The psalmist writes, God covers himself with light as with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a curtain. Think of a curtain, it's flat, right? Verse 3, he lays beams of his upper chambers in the waters. He makes the clouds his chariots, who walks on the wings of the wind. So think, you're walking, you're laying things out. This is all requires a flat surface, right? So some theologians actually took this to mean that the earth was flat. But it was very, very few amount, okay? It was just like a drop in a lake. So obviously doing Bible study 101, right? We learned to understand the genre of some of these writings. Did these guys actually mean these things to be literal or were they more metaphorical, okay? But we also have passages like Job 26:10, which I think give us a more clearer view of what the earth is like. So Job 26:10, that makes no sense at all. It says, he drew a circular horizon on the face of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. So when you look out into the horizon, you can see far enough, you see that it has a circular pattern there. So we know, and especially when you look up, it does seem there is kind of this dome, right? It's just noticeable. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 22. This one's a good one. Isaiah wrote, it is he, it is God who sits above the circle of the earth. Doesn't get any more plain than that, right? He sits above the circle of the earth. Well, where did this myth, basically, that medieval Christians and early Christians promulgated this view that there was a flat earth, how did it even begin? Well, we look no further than our beloved storyteller, Washington Irving, who, if you notice the name, he also wrote Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. His misrepresentations of the history of early New York City and of the life of Washington were topped by his history of Christopher Columbus. So how many of you heard that story, that Christopher Columbus was afraid to actually make the voyage because he thought the earth was flat? Right here. 1828, Washington Irving wrote his history of Christopher Columbus. He invented the indelible picture of the young Columbus, a simple mariner appearing before a dark crowd of benighted inquisitors and hooded theologians at a council of Salamanca, all of whom believed, according to Irving, that the earth was flat like a plate. Well, yes, there was a meeting at Salamanca in 1491, but Irving's version of it, to quote a distinguished modern historian of Columbus, was pure moonshine. Washington Irving, scenting his opportunity for picturesque and moving scene, created a fictitious account of this non-existent university council and let his imagination go completely. And he misled so many people. Wow. So that's the flat earth theory, guys, for your awareness. And lastly, we look at the Scopes trial. The Scopes trial is even more complicated, I think, than... It's crazy. Basically, in 1925, you had this legal case where a substitute high school teacher, John Scopes, he was accused of violating Tennessee's Butler Act, which made it unlawful to teach human evolution in any state-funded school. The trial was deliberately staged in order to attract publicity to the small town of Dayton, Tennessee, and by no other than the ACLU. Scopes was unsure. In fact, Scopes is on record as saying he was unsure whether he had ever actually taught evolution to any of the kids while he substituted at the school. But privately, because they wanted to get this trial going, privately they set him up with like a couple of students, and he basically taught them evolution. He incriminated himself for the sake of getting this trial going. All right. So it was deliberately staged. And then the ACLU was putting out kind of posters or advertisements to defend anyone accused of teaching the theory of evolution. And so you had this John Scopes guy kind of step up to the plate. On the seventh day of the trial, it lasted 8 days. On the seventh day of the trial, Clarence Darrow, who was the part of the defendant team, he took the unorthodox step of calling William Jennings Bryan, who was the prosecution attorney, and he was a three-time presidential candidate, and he was also a fundamentalist. Back then, they actually had a group called the Fundamentalist Christians, so he was part of these guys. William Jennings Bryan. So you have a lawyer calling a lawyer to the witness stand. It's weird. All right, this is unorthodox. But basically, he asked him for over 2 hours questions about the Bible and theology, basically trying to stump him, make a fool out of him, right? And I think they did. They accomplished that. Both of them, they just were out of whack. Questioning involved the book of Genesis, including questions such as, if Eve was actually created from Adam's rib, where did Cain get his wife, and how many people lived in ancient Egypt? Darrow, the agnostic, used these examples to suggest that the stories of the Bible could not be scientific and should not be used in teaching science. All right? So basically he's trying to show, well, if you can't teach evolution, why are you teaching this Bible mumbo jumbo or whatever? John Scopes, who was the party who's being defended, he was found guilty And it was basically Clarence Darrow, his own lawyer, that said, oh, you know what, we know that this guy's guilty. He incriminated himself. We know that we're not going to get a not guilty verdict. But just give us the verdict. We're going to take it to the Supreme Court, and we're going to see if we can get any further than this. They did actually have a plan. The ACLU wanted to kind of get this Butler Act out of the law, right? They wanted to show how dumb it was or whatever. But they didn't succeed. It went to the Supreme Court, and it failed. It got rejected. But then for some technicality, John Scopes was found not guilty. It was just a big show, okay? It wasn't anything real. It wasn't anything of real substance. But I think the one thing that it did do was show when they put William Jennings Bryan on the stand, is it basically showed that you have this, he's not a theologian, he's just a lay person. And he's up there trying to answer these very tough theological questions. And they're basically treating it as a circus, which it was. And what it actually did wind up proving is the fact it basically gave scientists and atheists ammo to show that, oh, these theists, they don't know what they're talking about. They're anti-science, they're anti-evolution, blah, blah, blah. They don't know what they're talking about. They shouldn't have a voice in the public square because of that whole circus. All right. So, yes, it was a deliberately staged act, but it did kind of wind up working on the side of the atheists and the skeptics, which is a sad thing. But we can show, again, we have this history. All right. This is conclusion. We have this history behind us. Christian theism provided a great framework for modern science to flourish. We have the facts behind us. We should see no conflict between having theological beliefs, having a faith in God, and also being a scientist. In fact, we also showed how science and theology can work together to go ahead and answer some fundamental questions about the universe, about life. All right? And I wanted to end on this. Things Christians should not say. And there's only kind of one thing. In your discussions with skeptics and atheists, I'm a big proponent of we have to use our words carefully. And I know in the heat of a conversation where things are heating up or you really want to win a conversation, first of all, that's not the right mentality. You should want to win the person, not the conversation or the argument. But when it gets to scientific matters, I know a lot of us tend to throw this one out. Science has proved such and such, that God exists. Now, I understand the intention behind it, but I think at the end of the day, it does more damage than good. Why do I say this? Well, remember what we just studied is the fact that we know that science can only take us so far. And remember one of the ways that science can help theology is that science can give us evidence, and it can help establish a premise in an argument. But it won't go so far as to prove. The fact that there is a beginning to the universe in itself doesn't prove that God exists, but it's good evidence in the argument to show that God exists, a philosophical argument, okay? And I hope you understand that distinction. So I hope that we as Christians, we can be better communicators with atheists and skeptics. And we shouldn't be throwing around things like science has proved, but we can show, well, science up to this point is showing good evidence, and I can actually use that evidence in a good argument to show that God exists. And I'll end with this quote. Since science is limited and progressive, we shouldn't expect complete agreement in every detail with the biblical presentation. However, the amount of present agreement is striking. So we as Christians have to be cautiously optimistic. All right, we shouldn't completely ignore science, but we also shouldn't completely elevate science to say things like science has proved. Remember, what if it's the case that there's a scientific conclusion that goes against our previous beliefs? That if we put our complete faith in science, and we've been over here saying science has proved this, but then there's a scientific experiment that disproves your previous statement, what are you going to do then? Be open to changing conclusions of science. Be cautiously optimistic, because we know if all truth is God's truth, then every time we do a science experiment, it should be getting us closer and closer to God. But remember, there's going to be changing conclusions, and we have to be ready to adapt to those. So we can't be saying things like science has proved. Okay? And so I'll end there, guys.